And those who come in person on the first or the last Monday of the month, we have a social gathering. So it starts at, what time does it start? 6 o'clock. So Chance, you can bring some food, chat with people. And it sounds like tonight was quite lively, lots of good conversation. So the next one's going to be on the 29th of December. So consider coming. Come a little early and make some friends. All right, so we're going to do a shorter talk, as I understand Carrie did a full talk last week. So we have a little space for you to do some small group discussion, because that's really important for you to bring forth your own understanding and sharing of your practice and to witness and hear other people. So tonight we're going to continue with mindfulness, wise mindfulness. And this is the last talk on this month. And we're winding up this year-long series on the Four Noble Truths. So we spent the first 3 months on the first three Noble Truths and the last 7 months, and next month be eight on the Eightfold Path. Right? So it's kind of all these numbers kind of swirling around. And tonight I like to kind of connect a little bit with how the whole Eightfold Path can work together, how it actually is integrated and really supported by wise mindfulness, and focus on wise mindfulness a little bit more as a final thing. So we can think of the Eightfold Path as eight strands that are woven together. So they are interconnected, they support each other, they depend upon each other. Without one of the strands, the whole cord becomes weaker. It's not as strong. It really depends upon it. And yet there's three of those strands. You can almost imagine different colors that kind of stand out. And those three strands help all the path factors work together. They actually activate them. They allow them to really to engage with them. And those three ones are wise mindfulness, wise view, and wise effort. Right? And there's a sutta, there's a lovely sutta called the Great 40 in Majjhima Nikaya 117. So Majjhima Nikaya is the middle length discourses, one of the bundles of suttas that we have from the Buddha's time. And the Majjhima Nikaya is one of the most primary ones that we study in this tradition. So this sutta has lots of details, but I want to pull out just this one little phrase to kind of give us some purchase around that, and seeing how they all work together. So this phrase is, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run and circle around all the other path factors. So the Buddha goes through each of the path factors and talks about how wise view is really essential for them to work, understanding what causes suffering, what's the release of that suffering. Without that, it's not wise anymore. And yet we need mindfulness to be able to be present, to actually know whether we're tracking that. We're actually applying wise view at this point. And we need effort, wise effort, to abandon what's unwise and to take up what is wise. And I think it's such a helpful and simple phrase to kind of work with. And also you can start to see how the Eightfold Path is really this interconnected, interrelated structure. It's not, we can just pull one out and study it, but really it comes alive when we bring them all together. And it also helps us to see how mindfulness by itself, sometimes that's one of our complaints that we get, or one of our protests about our meditation practice. Even in the guided meditation I gave today, is really about that receptivity. Allowing the breath to be just how it is, to release our normal habit of trying to control and change and fix, right? But there's lots of things in the world that needs to be fixed, right? There's things in our house that needs to be fixed, in our own minds. And so there's a passivity that sometimes is maybe perhaps rightfully leveled at Buddhist practice and meditative practice. But when you see it from the context of the Eightfold Path, it's not just mindfulness. There's also wise effort that's connected to it and wise view that's connected to it. So it brings that passive capacity, which allows us to see and perceive clearly. Right? And that's a key piece, is that if we're so busy, just take a conversation. Let's say we're talking to someone and we're so busy waiting to say what we want to say, or we're anticipating what they're going to say next, we're not really listening. We're not really taking in who and what they are in that moment. We're not perceiving them how they actually are. Right? So mindfulness allows us to perceive it. It doesn't really matter what it is. And mindfulness isn't just a breath meditation. I think that's also an important piece to highlight. I think Carrie talked about mindfulness of death last week, I should say. And so we can take different topics like that, or different, like we can take mindfulness of impermanence, of dukkha. And so we start to really turn our attention to that capacity. So it starts to meld with investigation. And even with our fundamental meditative techniques that we learn in like an intro class or on retreat, we often go through the body systematically. We learn how to feel our breath. We learn how to feel our body, the first foundation of mindfulness. We start to loosen our identification with that body, which I talked about for the first 2 weeks of this month. But the Buddha doesn't stop there. He actually goes into mindfulness. There's a whole factor on mindfulness, or a whole establishment of the four establishments of mindfulness on Vedana. So Vedana, is this pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it perceived as pleasant, perceived as unpleasant? Or is it perceived as neutral? Such a critical thing that we often overlook, but starting to notice that allows us to stop becoming so reactive and more responsive. Because if you don't catch that little bit of unpleasantness, before you know it, we're lost in aversion and reactivity, or lost in craving and seeking. To be conscious of that, then we start to have a choice of how we act. And even a deeper way, that starts to interrupt this whole self-mechanism process that's articulated in the dependent origination. And then the third mindfulness, foundation of mindfulness, is that of the mind, right? Of the mind. And that's that one foundation. It's interesting, the Buddha talks about just noticing kind of the shape of the mind, or noticing the kind of the quality of the mind without judgment. He says, notice when the mind is really calm. And notice when it's scattered, when it's suppressed, when it's really expansive, when it's concentrated. Notice when it's distracted. But it doesn't say, and that one is better and that one's worse. Right? That goes back to this quality of mindfulness. It's kind of outside of judgment, outside of preference. It just sees clearly what it is. From that seeing, that's when our actions flow from. That's when wisdom comes in. To start to understand, okay, this leads to more suffering. This leads to more ease. And then there's the actions that engages around that to bring that to life. So just how mindfulness is really supported by wisdom, because wisdom helps us see, when we see something clearly, then we know, okay, we can start to see, is this causing more suffering in my life? Is this leading to more contraction? Is this helping me understand, you know, my deepest insights, allowing me to really inhabit it? Like we had a weekend on anatta, non-self, this last Saturday. How that helps to enforce, that helps us to see it more clearly. Right? Mindfulness and investigation, I think, can start to blur together. I think of investigation as directed or informed mindfulness. Look in this direction, look in this arena, look in this area. Now wisdom, if you take that all by itself as a path factor, it's nice. It's nice to understand the nature of reality and nature of self, nature of suffering. But without it being connected to action, it's of a limited value. Without it being connected to mindfulness, which allows us to see clearly, it's also of limited value. And finally, action. You know, learning what is actually the right action to use right now. And unfortunately, I can't make a list here and say these are all the right actions, these are all the wrong actions. Because it's relative. It's relative based on how you are in the moment. I remember Jack Kornfield told us in our teacher training, he was listening or translating for Ajahn Chah, one of the most famous Thai forest masters, you know, from the near past. And he was listening to Ajahn Chah answer questions. And he said at one point, you know, I don't understand why what you're saying, because you told that one person to do this. And the next person, you told them the exact opposite. So what's going on? And Ajahn Chah said, if you're walking down the road and you're about to go into the ditch on the right, I'm going to say, go to the left. If you're about to fall on the left, go to the right. So it's that relativeness is how wise action starts to come forth. You know, what's the wise action here in this moment? So these three of wise view, wise effort, and wise mindfulness really work together. So I'd like to just make this a little more concrete with a couple, maybe three different examples to kind of bring it home. And the first one is a little bit not from the suttas. I don't think it's from the suttas. And that's, let's say we're baking a pie for Thanksgiving, all right? So baking a pie for Thanksgiving, where does view come in? What's wise view? We have a sense of what a pie looks like. You know, what's a pie that's cooked well? What's undercooked? What's overcooked? Let's say I want to make a pumpkin pie, but I only put sweet potatoes in it, or I put pecans. It's not going to quite work, right? What's that? So there was a comment about the Vedna of pecan pie versus pumpkin pie. All right, but let's say we have this intention to make a pumpkin pie. So with that intention, you know, that comes the overarching view, right? We know kind of what it's supposed to look like and how long it should bake and kind of the ratio of the recipe we're trying to follow. Maybe we imbue it with a quality of love. I'm really hoping that people are going to love this pie, are going to feel nourished by it if they have any room left in their stomachs after after everything else. And then wise effort then, of course, makes sense. I have to pay attention to how much salt I'm putting in, how much flour or sugar I'm putting in. If I'm just careless, it's not going to turn out very well. And mindfulness is what's knowing. It's aware of all of that. What's my attitude? What's my intention behind this? What shape am I trying to create? What pastry am I trying to make? Right, so you see how those three, we can see just an ordinary thing like this, those three are also operating. Well, here's another example. Let's look at our meditative practice. Right? Did anyone find their minds get lost in thought at all this last meditation? Now, this is such a critical thing when you notice how you meet that, how you relate to it. And right there, we can see that wise view and wise effort come to bear. Let's say your wise view is a little bit off, and every time you think, you judge yourself for it. You say, okay, I made a mistake. Why is this mind so busy? I've been meditating for so long. Why is it still doing this? Right? Which is just more thinking, by the way. Right? But yet that attitude, that view is a little bit off. It's one of trying to get someplace to be a certain, look a certain way as a meditator, have a certain experience as a meditation practitioner, right? And from there leads how we act from it. Okay, I'm thinking, I'm going to judge myself, and the mindfulness is kind of aware of that, aware of something more to judge. I'm thinking again, another thing to judge. Now let's interject, why is mindfulness? And maybe that's just as what arises. Can you stop yourself, your heart from beating? Can you stop your breath from flowing? You know, it's like this is what the body does. The lungs breathe, the heart beats, the mind thinks. The mind's always emanating thoughts. It quiets down, it can quiet down quite a bit at different times. But yet, if we just allow the mind to be how it is, and yet how do we meet that when the thought arises? I can choose to follow the thought. Okay, that's not quite the right effort because that's getting lost in it. I can choose to judge myself for thinking. That's not quite right either. But if I come back to just, okay, this is just another thing arising, like a sound that can allow it to pass through. Right? So mindfulness is aware of how you're relating and what attitude is coming forth. Okay, let's go a little bit deeper on that same example. Joseph Goldstein's one of his, I don't know if it's still his current way of practicing, but he once said that my main way of practicing right now is to simply not cling to anything, right? Not clinging means that he's not moving into that wanting or not wanting, not moving into that really that selfing around it that forms from the process of clinging. So let's interject that as wise view and our meditation. So then a sound arises, a sensation, a thought. Can I not cling to that experience? Can I allow it to rise of its own accord and pass away of its own accord? Right? So it's a very different relationship of wise view and of wise effort. And mindfulness is tracking all that. And let's go just a little bit deeper and notice the sense of self that arises. It's like, oh wow, I'm really meditating well. You know, I should tell somebody about it and maybe write a book or something. You know, proclaim that, how good of a meditator I am. Right? Or the mirror image, but still the same coin. I'm such a bad meditator. I'm failing at this. Okay, the sense of self is being activated. Now, if I have wise views, like, okay, maybe this is about softening that sense of self, softening that sense of identification. So then that's part of what I'm aware of whenever that arises. And then the effort is one of letting go of that. And the effort also is the courage that it takes to start to go into that territory outside of the sense of self, which can be inherently terrifying to that self. You start to relax into that. So wise view, wise effort, wise mindfulness all run together. And finally, just interpersonal communication is another way this can show up. So I know Thanksgiving is one of those holidays that Hallmark says it should be pretty nice, right? But sometimes it's really hard, right? Sometimes it's devastating because maybe it reminds us of what we don't have. Maybe it reminds us of the losses we've had, the people who are absent. Maybe there's just a really dysfunctional group of people we grew up with, and we get to spend the day with them, you know. And it's just, you know, we're just kind of bouncing off our own stuff. The worst parts of us seem to come out and play with the worst parts of them. And sometimes it's a lovely gathering, this deep connection. But just acknowledging that sometimes it's difficult. So we can bring the same quality to bear around communication. You know, how do I speak in this moment? What's really my overarching view in this moment? Perhaps it's trying to be of integrity, of trying to be true to myself, true what's here. So maybe say I'm a little cranky, I'm a little irritated. What's my opinion and how am I trying to force that on someone? Versus allowing someone else to have their own experience, their own understanding. So I say those words, you can see how there's more space that starts to flow. There's space for them to be who they are and for me to be who I am and my opinions. But realizing they're just my thoughts that I'm believing in. And so the effort is then, okay, do I add to that or do I start to soften that? Do I allow myself to listen or do I start to proclaim myself? And the mindfulness allows us to know all that's happening. So if one thing I can give you for a piece of advice is reserve a little bit of your awareness for your body while you're going through Thanksgiving. Feel your feet a little bit. 10%, 15% of the energy, just feeling that as you're speaking. That can be another wise view that, okay, I want to be embodied as I'm here. Maybe I want to have a sense of kindness. And I feel my brother say something that just triggers me and I get charged by it. Can I breathe into that charge? Can I make space for it? And can I choose to act, respond in a place of kindness, of wisdom, you know, versus creating more harm? And so hopefully you start to see how these three path factors really work together. They operate with all of them. Wise action, wise speech, wise intention. So, wise mindfulness, wise view, and wise effort. These three run circles around all the other path factors. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right. So I'd like to invite you to have some small groups. So we'll do this both online and in person. And if you wanted to skip this process, that's perfectly fine. If you're online, if you could jump off the call, would be great. And you can come back in 20 minutes. That way it's easier for the online people to navigate that. And then for here in the room, you can sneak out if you want. Or you can also just sit quietly by yourself too. That's fine too. So we'll have groups of 4 to 5 people. And again, these groups are really about a chance for you to witness each other, to witness your own expression and understanding of practice and your struggles and successes, and also for you to articulate and share your own. So it's really a gift when you share, and it's also a way of giving a gift back to the other people. And the topic would be simply around, what's the life for you around mindfulness? What have you learned about mindfulness this month? What is it something that you, or you maybe you want to learn more about, or really onward leaning around it? What's onward leading about mindfulness for you? So some topic about, just use the word mindfulness in there somewhere. Okay? All right, so we have 20 minutes. Monitor your time. It's not a time to give advice. You're not trying to solve other people's problems. You're just listening to each other. And again, we'll hold everything that's said in there confidentially. So afterwards, if you want to talk about your experience, that's great. But please don't talk about someone else's experience. Give them a chance to share that if they like. All right, welcome back, everyone. Looks like that was a lively discussion. So we have some space now for any sharing you want to offer around mindfulness, or any questions you might have around mindfulness, or anything in the Dharma realm is perfectly fine too. And in the room, you can raise your hand. We'll bring a mic over to you. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand and we'll call on you and let everyone can hear you.
So this feels like a very generic question. So I'm aware when I'm meditating, focusing on my breathing, that my sense of self, of where I am, is very definitely right above the breathing. I don't seem to have a sense of myself moving around anywhere, going anyplace else, and I'm wondering what others' experiences around that, if they pay attention to where they are when they're meditating.
Could we say that that's kind of where that perspective of observation is, like you're kind of there watching the breath?
Yeah,
so we can sometimes call that the meditative witness. In terms of where that's located, you know, I think, you know, some people, like for myself, I often feel it kind of more embodying the whole body. So it's not so much of a looking down. I don't know if we have to worry so much about where it is or not, but just be, you know, notice, okay, I'm in the meditative witness. Here's where I am located as I'm watching this experience of breathing. And that same perspective can notice, okay, there's a thought that's arising, or there's a distraction, and it maybe can kind of coax you back to connecting to the breath. And sometimes you might also play with seeing if you can observe that more clearly, where that sense of you who's watching and witnessing, let me see where that is, see if I can notice that a little bit more clearly. And as you do that, notice that somehow that sense of you that was watching is suddenly being watched by something else. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so then you say, okay, what's watching that? And you look for it, you see, and each time you get a little bit more quiet, a little bit more centered, a little bit more still. Maybe not centered, it's actually sometimes more expansive is a better word to say it. And then you might see that perspective of you looking down starts to change to not being so kind of that perspective of looking from one place.
Okay. So it is the case that there are other places to be.
Yes, yeah, I think there's other places to be. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I always find it interesting the contrast between the words you can say in a small group, and then the larger group is like, whoa. Nathan?
Hi, I'm Heather. Something I was reflecting on in the group is oftentimes in my life when I'm trying to approach things, I kind of have this element of, you know, grim determination, like plodding forward, rolling up my sleeves, like trying to really force things.
Yes.
And I found that over this last month, I think I've been able to integrate more mindfulness into things I've been going through, like applying for jobs and that sort of thing. But I still find that I'll still kind of go back to like trying to force things versus trusting that maybe I can relax and the work will get done, whether it's practicing meditation or just keeping that element in my life. I don't know if this is so much of a question, but just an observation I had that I wanted to share.
Yeah, it's interesting when we start to take meditative concepts or Dharma concepts and how they show up in other parts of our lives, because in some ways you can see it's really technology of how our minds work, how our attention works. And you think about, sometimes it's amazing to think about the Buddha and his capacity to understand the mind that seems so relevant even today. So part of that territory is like around effort, wise effort, you know, wise mindfulness, and also concentration, kind of the last three legs or things of the Eightfold Path. So concentration, it's interesting because sometimes we can really force it. And there's this one sutta where before the Buddha became awakened, he was just reflecting, okay, I'm really bearing down on my attention. I'm really pushing down. He used these kind of vivid analogies, like if two strong men were pushing me down, holding me down, crushing me, you know, that's how I crushed my mind. You know, and it was like all this sweat going through, and yet that didn't work. It was kind of his final realization. It got me one place, but it didn't get where I was really wanting to go. And then he learned more of that relaxed quality of mindfulness. And there's different kinds of mindfulness, right? Like we can go across in different, you know, Buddhist countries or different meditating teachers, and they define mindfulness in different ways. You know, maybe some of you have done a Goenka retreat where you focus on mindfulness first here, and then you focus on a sweeping technique of the body. You know, and so there's different ways of approaching it. And one way that's often resonant with our kind of background or lineage is more that kind of natural mindfulness. We're just allowing the moment to be how it is. So it's much more receptive quality. And so it's interesting to notice that in terms of effort and getting things done, you know, how much effort is really needed? You know, and can I, and this is something like I think it's Alexander technique, perhaps. Just how much energy does it, how much force do you really have to write? And can you make it as soft as possible versus like, you know, I'm going to carve through the wood to, yeah. So that's a nice thing to pay attention to. And a part of it is also the emotions and the mental behind it too. If I'm not really trying hard, me, am I being too lazy or I'm going to fail at it?
The word complacency kind of comes to mind. Well, if I don't force it, I'm being complacent.
Yes.
But, you know, it's almost like if I'm not doing it in this way, then nothing's happening. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like it has to be that way.
No, I think, yeah, so that's one of the things that mindfulness is so great at seeing is, okay, what's this attitude that's making everything make sense? And is that attitude even really valid or completely valid? And there starts to be some more freedom that maybe sometimes it's needed, sometimes it's not. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Good exploration. All right, go ahead. Tell me your name, how you say it.
Oh, Shaohan. Can you hear
Shaohan?
Me?
Shaohan? Yes, go ahead.
Hi. So during the meditation, sometimes I'll, you know, find kind of insights or realizations that feel very valuable. And sometimes afterwards, I'll like write them down or I'm like in the right headspace and I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to remember this, right? And then and then like the next day or something, I'll like read it and I'll see the words, but it doesn't connect quite the same. It's like I'm not where it almost feels like it's like a struggle to get back to that place, right?
Yes, yes.
So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about like should I go back or should I let it go or about like writing those down in general in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's really an important question. Would you mind giving me an example? Am I putting you on the spot too much?
Yeah, totally. You were mentioning that the equanimity, the idea of like being equally close to all things, right?
Yes,
and
yeah.
Maybe about a week ago, I was meditating with that and found that just really, you know, I kind of felt like I really understood that or felt it more so than just what the words were saying.
Yes.
And so then afterwards, I made it my phone wallpaper background. I typed that on a little note and then made it my wallpaper background to try to remember it more, right? So now every time I'm looking at my phone, I see that line of text. And, you know, the power kind of fades, right? It's not like I'm, like, getting back there every time I see that.
I see. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, so it's when we have an experience in meditation or in life, it's like there's a direct living of it. There's a direct knowing of it in that moment. And it can often feel very vivid, very alive for us. And then, okay, I want to get back to that. I want to recall it. I want to kind of capture it or I want to integrate it. Sometimes it becomes a little bit like the dog trying to find chase its tail. It's like the faster we go after it, the further away it gets. It's like the very attitude of trying to capture it sometimes makes it more elusive, which is kind of frustrating, right? It's very maddening that happens. What I would suggest is when you feel that sense of equanimity, to use your words, okay, that sense of equally close to everything, all things in this moment, notice how that changes your fundamental perspective of who and what you are. How there's some shift of seeing as a basis of that. Right? So you start to kind of flush it out that way. Even after the meditation, it's like, okay, this is this equally near all things. I got a taste of that. What's that like as I look at my, you know, my furniture in my apartment or my room or relating to someone else? Can I carry that forward? And you're going to find that sometimes it makes that investigation makes it really come alive. And sometimes it kind of gets in a way, you start to fake it and people don't like that. It's like, why are you acting like that? And I remember my wife doing that to me sometimes. And it's part of the territory there. So I think it's fine to write it down. It's fine to see how it changes. But kind of see it as it's something that you saw a moment into and start to see, okay, what would it be like for me to really live that way all the time? What would have to change? What would have to fall away? You know, and this starts to get into the territory pretty quickly of you realize you have to kind of let go of this perspective of isolation, of separation. And sometimes I go, I don't know if I want that right now. You know, separation kind of has its benefits, if you will, that I'm still kind of invested in. So I guess the bottom line is it's natural. I think it's fine to write it down and find things which inspire you and see if you can, you know, find ways to kind of bring that back alive. Almost like my teacher, the founder of Seattle Insight, would often talk about these vertical questions. And what he meant by that is horizontal is kind of the realm of time, future, past, you know, goals, failures, success, all those things. The vertical question drops us right into the present moment. And so you can use a question like that, maybe form a question like, where's your equanimity in this moment? Where is the equally near all things in this moment? And you drop that question and allow that to, it's almost like you're dropping a pebble into a water and you let the ripples come out of their own. So it's not so much your mind trying to do it, you're kind of calling that forth.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, so I'll come back to you, Kathy, in a second. Go ahead, Ryan.
It was interesting in our group talking about sort of each of us was talking a little bit about some of our experience in mindfulness, and it felt a little bit like blind men all feeling different parts of the elephant.
Yeah.
Right? There's, oh, it's a rope. No, it's a snake. But realizing that it's how much of mindfulness is also sort of like a process too. Right. One person in the group talked about how sort of mindfulness is sort of developing just the muscle memory to have awareness, right? Awareness of what you're feeling. Then a different person talked about mindfulness being about curiosity, right? And you know, where you go with it. And then another person talked about it being sticking with it. Right, like the Tiwari talking about how you got to just stick with it. You got to really sometimes really dive down, like almost like you were saying, that vertical question.
Yeah.
And then another person talked about then being aware of then what's underneath, right? And made heard a wonderful comment about, you know, then once you see what's underneath, what's present there, sitting beneath all that, and that all of that together. Being mindfulness and like what a really sort of big complex concept this is. So
yes, beautiful. Yeah, mindfulness. Another way to say it is mindfulness itself is completely simple, but what can be aware of is very can be very complex. Yeah, so there's all these different things we can be aware of. Yeah, that sounds like a nice discussion. Thank you, Ryan. Okay, Kathy, go ahead.
I too am, it's just been such a rich month of approaches to mindfulness, my goodness. One I've been trying lately is when I'm sitting, I have a tendency, I have an old habit of getting down on myself when I notice my mind has wandered or I've fallen asleep or whatever, most of my thoughts have gone astray. And but I got somewhere along the way the idea that just noticing that maybe is a thing I could celebrate because I'm back, however briefly. And I wondered how you what you might think of that or. If it would be helpful.
Well, before I tell you what I think about that, what's the effects of when you do that versus the effects of judging yourself?
Oh, I'm happy. Or at least, you know, new, happier. I feel and like, I'm back, you know, and this is good.
And how's the next moment of mindfulness? How is the practice then?
Sometimes I go along for a little while. Not always.
And then versus like when you, okay, I've messed up, I judged myself, how does the next moment of mindfulness go there?
It's not very good, really. It's not a very, doesn't feel very healthy. It just feels like someplace I don't want to be.
So when you celebrate the fact of waking back up, seems like the practice goes a little easier.
I think so.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a great way to do it. Yeah, I recommend that actually as a good technique is to celebrate the fact that you've woken back up versus criticizing the fact that you've forgotten because you're already woken back up. You know, celebrate that fact. Okay, I'm already here. And mindfulness, it's okay to feel that sense of joy, that sense of, oh, wow, I'm back here. I can... Because practice is supposed to be more and more joy and ease. You know, it's not the joy that we usually think of in our society of like the joy of these peak experiences, but it's just this quiet joy that's outside of conditions. Yeah, that sounds like that's a great way to practice.
Thanks, Tim. That's useful. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kathy. All right, anyone else? Yes.
The thing that's been most present in my practice recently is noticing how the habit pattern of anger is for me as a reaction to small and large stimuli.
Yes.
I'm just curious if you have any, what words would you have of guidance around that? Because I really understood it when I was reading, I'm reading the Noble Eightfold Path by Bhikkhu Bodhi right now. And there was just this line that was talking about anger and aversion. And I was like, oh, this little light bulb went on. So anyway, yeah.
Tell me about the light bulb.
The way I was describing it in our small group was like the light bulb, if it were a light bulb, it revealed there's like this little ember that I can feel.
Yes.
And sometimes it's just whoosh.
Whoosh being like it's like a flame. Big explosion.
Yeah.
How does it serve you? What's the benefit of it?
Kind of gives me something to push against.
Okay.
If I feel into it.
And the reason I've posed it that way is that sometimes we have a habit that we're viewing it as a problem, right? Much better if this wasn't a habit of my mind. And that very perspective tends to put a little bit of, it's like I put up a little bit of a mirror, like I hide part of it by wanting to get rid of it. That makes sense. It's like as it starts to shield itself, you know, because we're seeing just this one side, one facet, one element of it. But asking a question like, okay, how does this benefit me? Because we don't usually do things that don't benefit us in some way. You know, maybe it benefited us when we were a lot younger or in a different circumstance or kind of stuck in that pattern. But at some point, it really benefited us. So something to push against, right? And when you're pushing against something, that also, you know, and maybe a deeper level, it's you are there to push, right? You know, yeah, okay, I can manifest myself. I can just, you know, claim myself. I can push against. And so that's one way to look at it. It's kind of basically taking mindfulness, take this pattern, this habit pattern, and just say, I want to really observe it. I want to come back, reserve some of my awareness to see the pattern in itself. Without trying to fix it or get rid of it or judge it, but to just deeply understand it. So noticing that, okay, this benefits me, but I have something to push against. Or maybe there's some tenderness or some hurt underneath it. Or maybe there's a sense of not being heard or wherever it might be. And letting that be known also. Because if you go at an attitude of, I'm using mindfulness to see what I need to get rid of in myself, mindfulness has a little distortion in it. I think that's what we, as often as we do as practitioners, we're trying to really clean up our mindfulness to be really truly neutral without this kind of little bias. You know, and I think that's in our culture, mindfulness doesn't have that nuance. It's often be mindful so you don't screw up or be mindful so you do you're a better person, you know, versus mindfulness that really doesn't care what's there. It cares to see it in a full, wholehearted way. And in that full-hearted seeing, that's when it starts to let go of you. That makes sense?
It does. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that question. Thanks for willing to go a little bit deeper on that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. You bet. All right, anyone else?
So what you're saying there kind of this whole idea of mindfulness being completely neutral and not presenting things as a problem to fix,
I'm thinking of that in the context of recognizing when you're engaging in kind of selfing thought patterns or behaviors and whatnot. And that's something that is one of the quote-unquote goals of practice, is to kind of soften that over time. But can you speak to approaching that not from a position of trying to fix it, but as a way to kind of just like work with that a little bit more, and get closer there without viewing selfing as this evil thing that I need to get rid of, right?
Yeah, that's such an important territory, and that's where this talk around wise view comes in, and wise intention or wise action comes in around wise mindfulness. Because if we see the sense of self as a problem to overcome, what is really seeing that and proclaiming that?
That's the self right there. Yeah,
that's right. You know, and so the self, I mean, it kind of loves to have this problem of trying to get rid of itself, because it's kind of like, this is great. You know, I'm going to dig the hole and then you're going to fill it in, and we're just going to keep, you know, going, right?
Yeah.
You can spend a lot of time in that. And at some point it gets maddening, because you realize anything that you, any kind of attitude you're trying to get rid of, is just a more subtle quality of self. That's why we talk about mindfulness, this kind of neutral quality, this allowing the moment to be just how it is, helps the mindfulness develop, helps to see clearly, but also it makes the sense of self unemployed in that. You know, it doesn't have something to do
right
in the same way. And so then you start to wise view and wise effort start to come forth. You realize, okay, I can't get over myself by getting rid of myself. You know, there's a way that I have to just allow this to be just how it is. And at some point, then there's a clarity that comes in. You start to see the little bit of effort you can use. Okay, this energy brings that sense of self, allows it to come into birth. This way, it doesn't add to that. It falls into nothingness or emptiness from the sense of self's perspective. The reality is it's not everything. It's not very vast. And so it's really interesting territory, that it's like the more you try it, you know, and yet it's helpful to have that intention around it. So what I would say is just try to be completely kind to that sense of self. Not try to get over the sense of self. Not try to see it as a problem, but just try to understand it in a very deep way and start to see what's outside that sense of self.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. It's almost like putting in, like, there's a talking in on wise view and wise effort and whatnot. There's a level of effort to apply there with wisdom, as you're saying. But there comes a point where putting in too much effort is almost counterproductive.
That's right. That's right. And that changes over time. There's sometimes there's a lot of effort. Okay, I'm going to sit on my hands. I'm not going to write that email. Try to breathe through things. And then there's it gets more and more subtle.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's do the last question. Bob, would you like to go ahead?
Hi, Tim.
Hi, Bob.
That last questioner's question made me think of something Sharon Salzberg said, I think once, was you can't hate yourself into being a better person. So I've been wrestling with sati all month, and the word, and looking back at translations of it, and just noticing how common it is to translate it as mindfulness, but it also gets translated as awareness. And thinking a lot about, for me, one of the challenges of it, of Buddhist practice, and one of the appeals of it, has always been this idea of embodied awareness. And so I've been thinking about thinking, which I think I'm not an expert on this, but the Pali word for that, I think, is vitakka. And that's this kind of engagement with the world, with the mind. But I've been trying to be aware, be more fully aware. And I think that's the challenge of sati, is to be aware in the body as well as the thoughts or mind, and to know what's causing more or less suffering, more holistically than just by thinking about it. Am I understanding sati that in a unright way? What's an anathema?
You know, I'm not a scholar, so you know the details of sati, but the way you're describing it, I think, is a useful way to approach it. You know, is that way of that embodiment and that sense of expanding it, and to be able to see mindfulness from, you know, just what's being aware, to be that, you know, from different lenses or different strata. I think that sounds like you're on the right direction around it. You know, and awareness, you know, awareness is one of those words that sometimes we can say attention, awareness, mindfulness. Rodney would sometimes talk about mindfulness as this kind of directed quality of me being present, focusing on something, breath, body, you know, something much faster, while he reserved awareness for something which is outside of the sense of you. Awareness is kind of pre-you. So I'll throw that out there for you to contemplate.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just thinking about how, you know, where's the line between the mind and the body? And, you know, if you're an artist or a musician or something, I think you know and think through the extensions of your body, not just through your head, you know? And can you know what's causing more suffering or less suffering through the body? I just watching everybody in the room tonight, like the guy who asked about anger and how animated he got, you know, and how much he embodied the problem, you know.
Yes.
And the idea of pushing and pulling, and what do we know without thinking about it? You know, that's what I've been thinking about this month.
Yes, I think that's very helpful. We have this kind of schism between our bodies and our minds, you know, from our, you know, I'm sure someone could trace where that came from in our culture, our upbringing as a society. But that's an arbitrary distinction. So, you know, come into the whole body's knowing. What is the body's experience of this thought, this emotion? Yeah, I think that's a good direction, Bob.
Yeah, I think some things feel right and some things feel wrong.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're welcome. All right, thank you all for your engagement. This is such a helpful topic. And next week, we move to concentration, the final fold of the Eightfold Path. So I'll lead us off. Then we'll have Suze and Lyndall doing the eighth, and then Carrie will be here, and then I'll be here for the last 2 weeks. So we'll see where we go with concentration. Wise concentration. Thank you all. Enjoy your evening, and may your Thanksgiving be full of ease and peace. Thank you, online. Nice to see everyone. Thanks for joining us.